Congressman Findley represented the 20th Illinois District for 22 years. He was best known for his efforts to achieve peace in the Middle East and to promote human rights for Palestinians. I'm delighted Congressman Findley is participating in today's panel. I am also deeply honored that we are joined today by the 39th President of the United States, Jimmy Carter. President Carter was invited to Illinois College by Dr. Al-Habtour. So it is most fitting that Dr. Al-Habtour has the pleasure of introducing him. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Al-Habtour to the podium.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته President Jimmy Carter U.S. Congressman The Honorable Paul Findley President Barbara Farley Faculty Student of Illinois College My Phi Alpha Brothers Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. It is wonderful to be back at Illinois College. Illinois College is a very dear place to my heart. And the credit in introducing me to this place goes to my good friend, the former U.S. Congressman, the Honorable Paul Findley. Thank you, Paul. I am honored that President Jimmy Carter has accepted my invitation to visit Illinois College, and I look forward to the launch of the Path to Peace initiative with Mr. Carter. Thank you, President Carter. As you all know, President Carter tells the calls for solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict through my foundation, the Khalaf Ahmed Al-Habtour Foundation. I have worked with and support Carter Center for several years now, and I will continue to do so in their effort toward the Palestinian-Israeli conflict resolution. I will not dream and stick to the romance idea that the Palestinians will return to Palestine because there are different facts that have made this impossible and we have to live with them. President Carter and his team have worked very hard to find solution. Many like him and Paul are loyal to the cause and will not hesitate to do what it takes. The Palestinian-Israeli struggle is always at the forefront of my thinking. And while exhausting all the current solution, I thought, why not try a different approach? The idea of this initiative came to my mind. And after careful consideration, I discussed it with my team, and we suggest to Illinois College with assistance of Professor Andrew Findley and the faculty we have drafted this proposal that we call Pathway to Peace. Thank you, Andrew. Where is he? They should be asked to find scenarios and solutions to the conflict. They understand what their generation thinks and how they need to address this issue. Pathway to Peace is a seminar focused on historical examples of different religion, ethnic, and culture conflict and the step taken to resolve those problems. The example of method used to resolve this conflict can be applied as a potential pathway to peace. The faculty and students involved will travel to Jordan, and if the security situation allows, to Palestine and Israel. They will meet with Palestinian and Israeli students. They will try to understand them and their need first. My hope is that they can reach a realistic solution that could help the peace process move forward. I realize that the project will not be successful the first time, but will try again and again. This is too important an issue for us not to try every possible way to see it happen. President Carter, thank you very much for accepting my invitation. Thank you very much, sir, to be here in front of all these people. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. I don't want to speak longer than this. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Abdul, my good friend, and also my new friend, President Barbara Farley, and all of the trustees and professors and students of this wonderful college. It's a great honor for me to be here. I have heard many years about the wonderful work this college has done since its founding in 1829, and I was discouraged and kind of a little bit embarrassed to know that it's older than any college in Georgia. The University of Georgia was founded 4 years after you were, in 1833. Well, I'm also thankful for having been made a member this morning of the Phi Alpha Society, Literary Society. I'm proud to be one of their brothers now, and I look forward to carrying out those duties. I understand that Mark Twain and Abraham Lincoln are also members in the past, and so I'm the youngest member so far. I may be the oldest member when I was inaugurated into this great society. Well, a lot of people ask me how my life has been in the last few years, and the best response I can give them is a cartoon that was in the New Yorker magazine. This little boy is looking up at his father. He says, "Daddy, when I grow up, I want to be a former president." Well, I've reached that goal. I'm a former president now, and I have wonderful opportunities to visit 146 countries in the world. The Carter Center has programs in 80 different countries, and to come to exciting events like this is another great privilege of having been a former president. This lecture this afternoon, The Pathways to Peace, is one that I know is interesting to all of you. Most of us have some alignment with religion. I happen to teach Bible classes in my home church every Sunday that I'm there, about 35 times a year. And I know that my worship is to the Prince of Peace. I know that Islam and Buddhism and other religions, great religions, advocate peace and also basic human rights. It's sobering to realize that only once in the history of humanity has the entire world decided to commit itself to peace and human rights. And that was immediately after the Second World War, when over 50 million people were killed in Europe, East, Far East, and around the world. At the end of that war, the 45 or so nations that existed at that time decided to get together and to form the United Nations with a dream of forever having peace. And if there ever was a threat of a war or a conflict within a country or between two countries, the United Nations Security Council would meet, and they, in their wisdom, would decide how to address that conflict, and there would be no more wars. That was the dream. It has not been realized, as you know. Since the Second World War, the United States has been in armed conflict with more than 30 different nations. The other thing that was a dream then, a few years later, was to have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights declared, which from a Christian's point of view, fairly well summarized the basic teachings of our Savior Jesus Christ, the finest aspects of justice and peace and commitment of equality for all human beings. I wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times last fall and pointed out that the United States is now violating 10 of the 30 paragraphs in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But I was greatly impressed by the effort made in 1945 to 1948 to bring about these two dreams of humanity. When I was elected president, however, Israel and Egypt had been at war four times in the previous 25 years. The United States had been estranged from China for 30 years. The Cold War was ongoing, and there were wars breaking out already in the western coast of Africa and also the east coast, from Ethiopia down to the southwest corner of Africa. Those strains were very difficult for me to accept, but I resolved to do the best I could as president to put into effect, at least during my term of office, the dream that had been expressed in the United Nations and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I was able to bring peace between Israel and Egypt for the first time, beginning in the springtime of 1979. And now for 35 years, not a single word of the peace treaty we negotiated has ever been violated. There has been peace that prevailed between those two countries. That same year, I was able to form diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China. And now for 35 years, that has transformed in many ways the makeup of the political and economic relationships throughout the world. And when I went out of office at the end of 4 years, we had not fired a bullet, we had not dropped a bomb, we had not launched a missile against another country. So, in addition to that, when I gave my inaugural speech as president, I announced that human rights would be the basic foundation of our entire foreign policy. So we initiated a deep commitment to implementing all 30 paragraphs of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It had a profound effect on other parts of the globe. For instance, when I was elected president, as you would probably remember, if you go around the South African area, almost all of those countries were military dictatorships. And prior to that, the United States had sent troops in to make sure that no poor people or no indigenous Indians or others would overthrow the dictators who were in charge in those Latin American countries, in Peru and in Ecuador and in Chile and Argentina and Brazil and Paraguay and other countries. Well, by the end of 5 more years, every country in South America had become a democracy, and still is. A little bit different from us, the only one country still in this hemisphere that's not yet a democracy, and that's Cuba. And I hope soon we'll lift the embargo against Cuba and have relationships with Cuba that will help them find democracy. When I left the White House, as my wife points out, involuntarily retired by the 1980 election, I was only 56 years old. We had a life expectancy of 25 years, which I've always realized, and we didn't really know what to do. So we decided to found what's known as the Carter Center. And the Carter Center was dedicated in those early days to becoming a kind of a miniature Camp David. And the idea was that people who had an ongoing conflict or threatened conflict could come to me at the Carter Center, and I would negotiate peace between them if they wanted me to make that attempt. If they wanted me to, I would go to their own country and do the same thing. And the Carter Center still carries out that role. We go to Cuba whenever we want to. We go to North Korea. I don't want to go down the list. It would take too much time. But we have tried still to negotiate peace agreements, and that's one of our major commitments. We had this as well, and that is under the umbrella of human rights. If I ask the average student in the class, or even the average adult, what are the major human rights that are important to you, you would probably say freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of worship, trial by jury. That would be about it. But if I go to the 35 countries in Africa where the Carter Center is involved and ask them, what is the basic human right that you feel most precious? They would say, we would like to live in peace. And we would like to have a decent home in which to live. We would like to have food for our children to eat and a modicum of education and maybe some health care. You see the difference in attitude depending on how blessed we are with human rights that are basically guaranteed. Almost all of us have a decent home, and we have food to eat, and education, and health care. But without those things, the people suffer. And I would say that peace would be the basic founding of all of those. I wrote a book called Talking Peace, and I want to make a comment that it was written by Dutton, which is a primary producer of textbooks for classrooms. And Talking Peace is used as a textbook in many colleges and high schools in the United States these days. But he points out the fact that the basic cause of conflicts between two nations, or the basic cause of conflicts between people within a country, a civil war, is almost exactly the same as a conflict between an incompatible husband and wife, or between a father and sons, or between two students on a university campus. It's a matter of having a difference that cannot be resolved and not having enough respect for the other person to discuss that difference and try to resolve it yourself. Or if that's impossible, if one is too proud to acknowledge the other as an equal for communication, then call in an intermediary. So the basic causes of conflict are standard. They're the same. And I know that now with this lecture, that this great college is devoting itself to resolving that. The Carter Center found that when we have a civil war between two generals in a country, quite often the people of that country are tired of the war. And sometimes when they would come to me to negotiate between them, I would find it impossible because they wouldn't relate to each other. The generals wouldn't even let me be the intermediary between them and the other side. So we evolved the concept of the principle of politics, and that is self-delusion. As Paul Finley would know, anybody who runs for office is convinced, I am the best candidate and I will be elected. Self-delusion. And I would tell those two generals who were at war, why don't you let the Carter Center come in and hold an honest and fair election? And I'm sure the people of your country will choose the right person to be president. And they always thought I would be the choice, and they let me monitor elections. And the Carter Center just finished monitoring its 96th troubled election in the world. So democracy and freedom So you see that democracy and freedom are integral aspects of the maintenance of peace within a country or between two countries. The Carter Center is deeply involved in the Middle East. We have full-time office, and it has been that way for 20 years, in Jerusalem, in Ramallah, in the West Bank, and also in Gaza. We have a full-time staff in Gaza. And when I go to the Middle East, I meet with the leaders in Israel, and then go to Ramallah to meet with the Fatah element of the Palestinians, and we also go to Gaza to meet with the people there, because we feel that there must be an end to the war in the Middle East. And I think my dream has been, for now for 35 years, is to bring peace to Israel. And there's no way to bring peace to Israel without having peace and justice for their neighbors, the Palestinians. We're still working on that, and we'll continue to do that. The basic principle under which the Carter Center works is the same thing that was established by the United Nations in 1967 when they passed United Nations Resolution 242. It was voted yes, by the way, by the United States. It was voted yes also by Israel. And it calls for the withdrawal of Israel from occupied territory and also the granting of equal rights to the Palestinian people. That's still the official policy. That's still the official policy of the United Nations, of the United States of America, of every country in Europe, and of almost every country on earth, is to bring about a two-state solution in the Middle East. And that's what the Carter Center is working on, and I'm sure that's what Paul Finley would like to see. I'm sure that's what Dr. Abdul would like to see. It's what the people in Israel would like to see. It's what the Palestinians would like to see. We'll never give up on that effort as long as I have life. And I believe and hope that after this next election, as you know, sometimes American foreign policy is determined, I hate to say this maybe, by the election process, but after the election in November, perhaps the United States will reassert again its effort to bring about an implementation of this dream to bring peace to Israel alongside a peaceful Palestinian state, and that both of them would recognize each other to be able to live in peace. That's what it takes in the future, and I hope it'll come to pass in my lifetime. The Carter Center also has other programs. We have an ability to speak to leaders in the world since I was the president of the greatest country on earth, and we also have an ability sometimes to let ourselves be heard. I teach at Emory University now. This is my 33rd year as a professor there, and sometimes the news reporters will come to my class when they know I'm going to say controversial things, but also have a chance to write books. And then when I write a book, I can make a tour on the Daily Show and to New York Times and things like that, and express my views more openly. I've just finished my 28th book, which I think, by the way, is the most important book I've ever written. It's called A Call to Action, and it describes the most horrible human rights abuse that's not addressed in the world today, and that is the discrimination and abuse of women and girls. And alongside bringing peace to the Middle East and other places in the world, the Carter Center will devote a major portion of its effort in the future to alleviating this discrimination. It's not just in foreign countries. The mutilation of women's sexual organs is one of the things that is terrible. In Egypt, where this is not legal, over 90% of every female alive has had her sexual organs mutilated. And in some countries like Djibouti and other countries, it's up as high as 97%. There are 25 countries in Africa where it's over 50%, and it still goes on. This is not mandated in the Quran. It's not mandated in the Bible, but a lot of people continue to do it. You all know about honor killings, where if a girl is raped and she's completely innocent, her family feels that she should be assassinated because she has brought dishonor to the family. And most often that assassination is done, that murder is done by the father, the father's brothers, or quite often in some countries now by younger brothers of the girl. Because if they're under 18 years old and they're found guilty of murder, the punishment will be as a juvenile. The United States is not immune from this embarrassment. Atlanta, Georgia has the distinction of having the busiest airport on earth. In Atlanta, Georgia, every month, there are between 200 and 300 people brought into this country and sold in America as slaves. 80% of those are girls sold into sexual slavery. And the reason Atlanta is so popular in that area is that we have a lot of passengers in our planes from the Southern Hemisphere, where the girls' skin is brown or black. And they are sold into a brothel for an average of about $1,000 to serve against their will as a sexual slave. Last year, the State Department of the United States is required by law now to give a report on slavery, or human trafficking as it's called. And the State Department reported that in the United States of America now, there are 60,000 people living in slavery, in involuntary servitude. One of the greatest places for abuse against women, sexual abuse, is on the great universities, campuses of America. But the deans and presidents of those universities don't want to admit that those crimes take place on their campuses. So when it happens, the girl is cautioned, don't make an issue of it. Let's don't report it. We'll counsel with the boy who's guilty, and maybe it'll go away. And it does go away. As a matter of fact, 41% of all the universities in America have not reported a single sexual assault in the last 5 years. This crime goes on unabated. Now there have been 88 countries named by the Department of Education, which I created, by the way, when I was president, as being violating Title IX, which was originally written to make sure girls had an equal chance to participate in sports on the campuses, as you know. And now they have extended this Title IX section to require that universities do something about it when girls are abused on the college campuses. The Justice Department says that the rapes on the college campuses are primarily perpetrated by just a few boys who, when they get to college, begin to realize that they can take advantage of girls in this way with total impunity. If they do it on a college campus, they won't be tried, they won't be convicted, they won't be embarrassed. As you know, the Heisman Trophy winner at Florida State University was guilty of raping two girls on a college campus. He's still playing baseball, still playing football. Well, these are the kind of things that go. And it not only is it in the university campuses, it's also on our other great university, great institution, and that is the military. The Department of Defense reports that year before last, the last time we had a report, there were 26,000 cases of sexual abuse in the military. And commanding officers now have the right to decide, is this crime going to be reported or not? And most of the time they say no, it'll be ignored. Of the 26,000 cases, only 3,000, that's about 1%, ever brought the perpetrator to justice. These are the kind of things that we still face. And I look upon all the human rights as contributing to the right of a human being to live in peace. I'm very grateful this afternoon to be here and to let me associate my own self personally with this great college. Thank you for giving me the honor of giving this lecture, and I hope that in the future, Illinois College and your president and your deans and your students will continue to maintain the high standards that have been set now for 129 years. Since 1829. Thank you very much.
Thank you, President Carter. We now come to the question and answer portion of today's event. I received many questions from students and from faculty and have selected six, two for each panelist. And each of you on the panel have 3 minutes to answer these questions. The first question, Dr. Al-Habtour, is for you. How badly did the war this past summer between Israel and Gaza set back the Arab-Israeli peace talks?
No doubt there is a mistake from both parties, from both sides, but even if there's a mistake from Gaza or Hamas, we cannot blame the people of Palestine by butchering them, dominating them, and the attack Israel did. I mean, it doesn't worth it. I mean, what Israel did really is a massacre against all the civilian men and women and children. Of course, I don't support Hamas myself. I'm against Hamas, but I don't blame. I blame Israeli, and even during that time, unfortunately, U.S. government was supporting and sending weapons to during that battle to the Israeli to use them. And I will suggest that should be taken to the criminal court and investigate all this, provided the Palestinian accept to be a member of the criminal court. Thank you.
President Carter, the next question is for you. Can the United States do anything to restart the nearly moribund Arab-Israeli peace talks?
The United States can do something, but the question is, will the United States do anything? I think when President Obama was elected president, he made a wonderful speech in Cairo where he wisely pointed out no more settlements. But since then, the settlements have continued, and it seems obvious to me that Israel's plan is to confiscate the property that they want all the way between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River, which means the entire West Bank, and also East Jerusalem, which is part of Palestine. But as I mentioned in my talk, I believe when election time comes, the pressures of constituencies in America deter the president from taking bold action. My hope is that after the election in November, the first week in November, as you know, that President Obama and the Secretary of State John Kerry will renew the United States' commitment to bringing about peace based on, as President Obama himself pointed out, the 1967 borders, modified to some degree by good faith negotiation between the Palestinians and Israel, and also by the fact that the two states will be formed. And those two states would be with the Palestinians on one side, including Hamas and Fatah, and also between by the Israelis on the other side. If necessary, I think that there should be a United Nations contingency there, particularly including American troops. And this was something that I did when I had the peace treaty between Israel and Egypt. We put American troops and others in the Sinai Desert to make sure that the peace prevailed. I think the same thing could be done in the West Bank to make sure that Israel could remain at peace and that the Palestinians could remain at peace. So my hope is, and my prayer is, that the United States will take action of a very strong nature to induce the Israelis and the Palestinians to go back to the negotiating table. And I would say that John Kerry and the President could lay down some basic premises on which the peace could be presumed. And that is 1967 borders with modifications, a two-state solution, and mutual recognition of each other with a peace contingent if necessary to preserve the peace.
As a follow-up, President Carter, what could the United States do to encourage Israel to support the solution that you've just described?
Well, the United States has a great deal of influence in Israel when it wants to exert its power and authority. For instance, for many years, the United States has given Israel $3 billion a year, which is about $300 million a day. And this is $10 million a day. And this, I think, should be continued to Israel, but that's something that could be mentioned by the President to the Prime Minister of Israel. I'm sure it would get his attention. Secondly, I think what Israel wants to have is peace. And the United States could commit itself completely, along with the United Nations and other nations, to make sure that Israel could live in peace. Because one of the things that Israel fears is that if they do grant the Palestinians a state next to theirs, that there will be rocket attacks and other things going into Israel. But with an adequate international peacekeeping force, including some American troops if necessary, I think Israel could be guaranteed that they could live in peace. I think over a period of time, there might be some remaining opportunities for Israel to have control of the air cover, perhaps over the West Bank and Gaza. But this is something that could be negotiated only with the Palestinians. My own hope is that Abu Mazen, or Mahmoud Abbas, who is the present leader of the PLO, will exert more of his authority as well. On April the 24th of this year, the Fatah and Hamas agreed to have a sectarian government, a government that had no members from Hamas and no members from Fatah. And that government has already been identified, the cabinet has. And now we're waiting for the Palestinians from the West Bank to go into Gaza and reassume control over the entry into Gaza from both Israel and from Egypt, and also to guarantee that all of the materials that go back into Gaza now are used for peaceful purposes to rebuild homes and schools and hospitals and not used for military purposes against Israel. That agreement has already been signed, but it needs to be put into effect. So those are two or three of the things that still are outstanding that are there on the table. They're understood by everyone. They just need to be implemented, and they can only be implemented by the full exertion of American authority and influence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Congressman Findley, we turn to you. Could you express what you believe Dr. Al-Haftour and President Carter can contribute to peace in the Middle East?
We have the privilege of being with two giants here today. I served in Congress when Jimmy Carter was president. He stood up to Israel's unfortunate attitude on the Palestinians as nobody since Dwight Eisenhower. But he stood firm, and the Camp David Accords produced a document that supposedly proposed a two-stage advance of the Palestinians from their present state of servitude, as I would call it, to complete independence and freedom. The intermediate step never occurred, despite the promises of Prime Minister Menachem Begin to the contrary. So I see very little that we can do here at this table or at any other table. The situation is so grim that I see the only hope in the person of Barack Obama. And I must say it's a slim hope, but he is the one person on earth who could bring about peace in the Middle East. If he has the courage of, let's say, an Abraham Lincoln, who used an executive order to bring forth the Emancipation Proclamation, in this circumstance, to have the courage and the wisdom to suspend all aid, U.S. aid to Israel, until Israel formulates a peace treaty with the Palestinians. That is a long shot. But President Barack Obama is the only person on earth who has the power in his hands to do that. And I hope that after the midterm elections, he'll have some reflective thoughts on what he still can do as president to make this a better world. And I can't imagine him using an act of tough love against Israel to bring the people of Israel to their senses, because the break would just change the horizon of every element in the Middle East, from clouds to bright sunlight. It would be the best thing that could happen to the state of Israel. Israel, for the first time, would be at peace with all nations on the map of the world. It would have an assurance of a Jewish majority until the end of this century at the very least. And of course it would be brilliant news for all mankind. Now that may not be a direct response to your question, but it's the best I can do.
Thank you.
President Carter may have had the same difficulties with Congressman Findlay. Dr. Al-Tour, we return to you. Many of the issues of peace between Israel and Palestine center on economic disparities. What can be done to foster economic growth and development in Palestine?
Economic and politics is related very much. And the situation, there is a lot of turbulence now in between the Palestinian and the Israelis. I agree with Congressman Paul Findlay that if the only hope that if President Obama take initiative and have the decision this time, we need his decision this time, to put his thumb and push both to accept each other, otherwise there will be no solution. Economic situation in Palestine and in Gaza in trouble. People, they don't have shelters. People, they don't have food. No business, no recruitment, and nobody is hiring them. We put our hand as an Arab. You know, we want to shake hands with the Israeli, but never accepted. They never accept. I know I have a lot of friends from Israel and the Jews, and they are great people to know. But unfortunately, the government there is anti-peace, and the only people who want to do it, and we are really tired from the promises from the leader of the world, especially, I mean, after President Carter, he did a great job by doing the agreement between the Egyptian and, but after that, there's nothing happened to the Palestinian, and we need really a pressure. The aid, the money, the weapon which is from the United States, from the taxpayer, this should be really frozen. They should be stopped until the peace and the peace agreement, and it should be two states or one state. And this is the only solution. Otherwise, I mean, in our own, we'll try as in our own capacity, but it will not succeed as much as we wish. But we expect, and I in person, and a lot of Arabs, and a lot of people, they need really that the White House, President Obama, to have the encouragement. He has the power to put his thumb and push them all into peace. And I promise you, if he do that, you know, not by only negotiation. Sometimes we are further from negotiation. It needs a decision. It needs an instruction. It needs an order. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Al-Haktour. President Carter, given Malala Yousafzai's recent receipt of the Nobel Peace Prize for her advocacy for the education of girls in Pakistan, and your recent book on women, religion, violence, and power, could you please comment on the role of women and religion in movements for peace?
Every year at the Carter Center for the last 20 years, we've had a conference concerning human rights. And we assemble what we call human rights defenders. These are really human rights heroes. And we invite them each year from about 40 different countries where human rights violations are very severe. The last 3 years, our topic has been the abuse of women and girls. And we've had these people come to our center to give their own views about the plight of women in their country and what they're doing about it. One of the things that's become clear to me, particularly from the women of Malaysia and the women of Egypt and other places, and Jordan, is that the Quran does not condone any discrimination against women. And I have an ally in the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar University in Egypt. They have 120,000 students in Al-Azhar University. He's also the president of the university. And he is the spiritual leader of many Sunni Muslims, and they comprise about 3/4 of a total Muslim community in the world. And he is working side by side with me on this project of doing away with discrimination against women and girls by pointing out that there is nothing in the Quran that condones the discrimination against women and girls. And the women are now becoming more and more active in pointing out themselves to their own governments, no matter where they live, that this is true. It also exists in the United States of America. We know that some very wonderful people, for instance, very wonderful religious leaders in the Southern Baptist Convention, which I used to belong to, and also in the Catholic Church and so forth, ordain that women are not equal to men in the eyes of God. That is, they can't be priests, they can't be deacons and so forth in the church, but men can. And so one of the things that causes the discrimination against women and girls is for some people to distort that religious teaching and say, well, if women are not equal in the eyes of God, why should I pay my employees who are women the same as I do a man? Or if it's an abusive husband, he might say, why should I refrain from abusing my wife if she's not equal to me in the eyes of God? And so forth. So this religious misinterpretation of the scriptures is a very serious problem. And that's where women are becoming more and more vocal in pointing out that neither Christianity nor Islam nor the other great religions in the world preach or condone discrimination against women and girls. And they are very heroic. In some places they are persecuted because they become spokesperson for female equality. But I think that's what can be done in the future by women, and that's what is already being done in this country and around the world.
Congressman Finley, peace is often viewed as an idealistic abstraction. We've lived without peace in the Middle East for a long time. What would peace in the Middle East look like in the 21st century?
The Palestinian people are very competent. They're bright people, they're ambitious, they want a good life, a better life than they've had, and they deserve it. I do believe that the demographic power at work in the Middle East is going to bring change. It may bring violence, it may bring civil war, it may bring a terrible agony, but it could bring peace and opportunity. If the people of South Africa could work out the desperate apartheid system under which most of their population existed, surely the people of the Middle East can do the same. I have that confidence. But it's going to take cooperation on the part of the U.S. government, or it's not going to happen. They stand ready to move into statehood tomorrow. But our government is frankly hooked to an Israeli foreign policy and in addition to a domestic policy that gives our representatives no wiggle room. They're puppets. And that's a sad commentary, but it's an accurate one. So there's going to have to be a big change here in America for the blossoming of a great new age in the Middle East. Madam Chairman, I'd like to say a word about Jimmy Carter. That man moved out of the White House and went back to Plains in Atlanta, but his presidency did not stop. It continues to this very day. I don't know of any president in history who has been so committed to his country and to getting good things done who matches the skill and determination of our guest today. Established a Carter State Department, a Carter Foreign Assistance Act program, and he's done it without any taxpayer money. Believe it or not, he today, with the work of the Carter Center, employs over 150 people with outreach missions in several countries, most of them in the Middle East. The only figure in American history that I can think of that comes close to him is the record of John Quincy Adams, who, after two terms in the presidency, ran for election to the House of Representatives, and there he served until his death. I hope both of our guests today, because Dr. Haptura is a giant too. He's a big man in business, he's a big man in charity, he's a big man in philanthropy and in education. And his presence today is a great compliment to this country college of ours that we're so proud of. One more point. Hey, as the farmer said as he crawled through the barbed wire fence, one more point and I'm through. Several years ago, I was watching television at home, the evening newscast, and suddenly there appeared on the screen Jimmy Carter with head bowed at the grave of Yasser Arafat, the president of Palestine. I was so thrilled to see that, Jimmy. I have never forgotten it. I stood up and hand saluted you. You probably didn't know that, but I did. It just made me realize that there are some truly great people in our society, and two of them are here tonight, or this afternoon. I'm grateful to have the blessing of their friendship. And I think they give us hope for the future, that this can be a better world. So I hope they have many years of good health and service to come. Thank you.
Congressman Bentley, that provides an excellent transition to the last part of our program today. I thank all of our panelists for their stimulating thoughts about creating the conditions for peace in the Middle East. We know that the problems of the Middle East are deep-seated, very difficult to resolve, and the presence of our speakers today and the existence of the Pathways to Peace initiative, which Dr. Al-Haktour announced, represents our collective belief that someday peace can be achieved in the Middle East. We turn to awarding a degree to President Carter. Our chair of the board, Joy French Becker, will escort President Carter to the front of the stage. President Farley joins me. President Farley, upon the recommendation of the faculty and with the authorization of the trustees of Illinois College, I have the honor of presenting President Jimmy Carter to you for the degree of Doctor of Humane Letters.
Of Illinois College and the Board of Trustees, it is my great honor to recognize President Carter this afternoon for his lifelong pursuit of peacemaking around the world. The following resolution has been approved with great enthusiasm by the Illinois College faculty and Board of Trustees, and it reads, whereas former President Jimmy Carter has provided sound and compassionate leadership to the citizens of the United States as the 39th president. And whereas President Carter, through the establishment of the Carter Center, has dedicated his life to citizens of the world by advancing human rights, alleviating human suffering, promoting democracy, mediating conflicts, and monitoring electoral processes in support of fair and free elections. And whereas Illinois College wishes to recognize President Carter's tremendous contributions to peace negotiations across the globe and honor his selection as the 2002 Nobel Peace Prize laureate, now be it therefore resolved that the Illinois College Board of Trustees honors President Jimmy Carter by bestowing upon him the degree of Doctorate of Humane Letters, honoris causa. Congratulations, Mr. President. I thank once again Dr. Al-Habtoor, President Carter, and Congressman Findley for the inspiring messages they offered to us today. We will take their wisdom and ideas with us as part of the Pathways to Peace initiative. Please remain standing as you are able as the platform party and faculty recess out of the arena. Thank you all very much for being here this afternoon.
Thank you for that.